Very good evening to everyone. I think first of all I have to honor and acknowledge each and every one of you for actually turning up this evening. It's a very cold evening, very windy, very wet day. It has slowed down a bit now. But I do want to acknowledge you for taking the effort to actually come and show up. And in as far as Buddhism is concerned, showing up is one of the key characteristics or values to have, because it is all about approaching reality as it is. So in having attend, I think that is something they are working towards developing already. Then again, I think tonight's topic, Buddhism for busy people, or maybe is this that you've looked through the list of the talks for this semester and say, if I were to attend one out of my busy schedule, which one should I go to? So maybe that's the reason you're here. But regardless, we have about 1.5 more hours together. And during this period of time, what I've been asked to do by Ian, I always take instructions from him, is to do a bit of coverage of Buddhism as a whole, but then give a bit more emphasis on one particular aspect of Buddhism, which is, I believe, the core aspect of it as far as the practice is concerned, and also something that I've been very passionate about. I spent many years examining that, researching that, and also it is part of the theme for the upcoming Bodhi Night. So let us tackle all three things at the same time. But really, even without Ian telling me that to give emphasis on one particular aspect of Buddhism, which is mindfulness, when I looked at the topic, I already knew that you cannot go away from talking about mindfulness when we talk about practical Buddhism, especially when we talk about practical Buddhism for busy people. So let's take a step back first. When we talk about busy people, I think all of us kind of fit into that mold at one time or another. And for some people, that is their whole life, including me at some points too. The pace of life has gotten really, really quick. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when you send an instruction out, you mail it out, and after a while, you get a reply a few days later. These days, with these things, that's a phone, by the way, you know, one hit of a button, the other person receives, yes, comes back, oh, no rest time, no downtime. Go, 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 go. So busyness has become our business. Whether you are a student, whether you are working, whether you are not working, the pace of life is such that everything is kind of in a constant flow, constant flux. Now don't take me wrong, it's not that 2,000 years ago things were not in a constant flux. But the amount of flow and the amount of data that we receive as an individual has, I don't know how many times, increased in how many fold now. And I think you do know that, and you do recognize that too. You switch your computer on, either this way or this way, and then you will start doing this. Come on, why are you not loading yet? Alright, control and delete, alright, put your password in, come on. And then when it's loaded, okay, quickly click Internet Explorer or your whatever Mozilla that you use. First open window and click a certain button, 6 windows open up. Subtext. Alright, okay, Yahoo is open, Gmail is down, okay, Facebook is on now, okay, I'm on Twitter now again. As you can see, the pace of life is such that we are constantly moving to different things. And when things actually slow down, we say, what's wrong? What's this problem or that problem? And I think from the last, I think people can sort of relate as well. And how many times we get impatient about things because we are moving, used to moving at such great rapidity. great speed, that constantly the mind is into one thing after another. In fact, just before coming here, I was reading an article, a bit of research on multitasking. These days, people pride themselves, you know, I can multitask, you know, and go to interviews. Give me an example of you multitasking. Luckily, I prepared last night and got my case study already. Well, when I was doing this, I managed to... In fact, multitasking is sometimes seen as a good quality. But when we really look at it, the research data suggests... Now, let me again take a step back. I'm first and foremost a Buddhist practitioner. I also teach Buddhism and teach meditation. But at the same time, I'm also a scientist. I'm also a clinical psychologist. So I always try to look at things from two different perspectives. What the traditional perspective says and what science is saying. Because if both are claiming to be trying to understand reality, an evidence-based reality, then there has to be some integration between the two. So, let me continue on. Multitasking. The research data suggests that although we may be very good at multitasking, doing a few things at the same time, sometimes doing five or six things. You're replying to an email, you're calculating your thing, you're doing your assignment, you're watching the TV, and you're talking to your friend in the kitchen, right? And with a messenger or whatever that you have, and having to reply to them. Multitasking. People used to think that multitasking is a good thing. You can multitask. Good worker. You can throw five tasks at the same time, you can juggle it. But now research has shown that, and it's very interesting, the research term that they use for people who multitask is people who engage in continuous partial attention, CCPA. Right? Continuous partial attention. Right, you get the picture. Right? You can even feel it. You live it. We live it. Alright? Let's be real here. At different parts of the time. What they find is that people who engage constantly in CCPA tend to have worse memory overall. Attention span is actually very poor. They get distracted very easily, and they are more prone to stress and tension. Sounds familiar? If not familiar, wait a bit to assignment time. Wait a bit to exam time. I think we personally know that when we multitask, our quality and our state of our being, our sense of our mind, and as an individual, it's not in a good place. And what they found more interesting is, if they measure IQ, now IQ, intelligent quotient, is a measure of our cognitive capacity, and takes into account a few different things, including attention, memory, and all these things. What they find is that people who constantly engage in CCPA have an average drop of IQ score by 10. For some of you who are more inclined towards statistics, this is 15 is one standard deviation. So 10 is quite a significant drop. Not a full standard deviation drop, but a significant drop. So people who multitask, in fact, are not better off in the long run. They may seem to be more productive, but their productivity efficiency goes down. Their sense of well-being goes down. Their stress and tension shoots up. Heartbeat. You go to sleep. Dreaming. Right? And we know that our stress levels, our tension levels go up. Immunity. Our own ability to self-regulate and protect the body and our health goes down too. And this is very clear when you have got an assignment period, you rush, you finally hand the assignment in, next day, cannot get out of bed. Right? One sickness or another, sore throat, flu, cold, depending on what's the flavor of the month. Yeah? You're vulnerable to it. So, not very useful. And besides that, you're just often tired and exhausted. If you're overly busy, you're constantly just exhausted and tired. You ask, how are you going? Don't talk to me. Busy. Not available, away. And we talk about, we don't exist in a vacuum. We exist in relationship to other people. Yeah? And when we are very busy and we are tired, we're stressed out, what happens to our relationship? not very good, yeah? You do not really connect with a person. Or other people do not connect to you. Right? If you know that someone is very stressed out, you kind of feel that there's like an energy around them that is like, go away, go away, go away. So you go near them, whoa, better stay clear from them. Right? But when you are stressed, it's the same thing. You're kind of beeping up. Go away. Right? Talk to the hand. So our connection, our relationship with other people, that drops as well. Now I'm talking about in the cases of extreme busyness. I think it's inevitable that we as householders, i.e. people who are non-monastics, will be quite busy in our day-to-day lives. Because being productive, surviving in this world, we have to be somewhat productive. Right? But there's a certain level when it passes that's when it becomes damaging. And this is the type of busyness that I'm targeting and talking about this evening. And I think all of us at some point can gain something out of this. Because inevitably, especially being uni students or working or whatever it is that you're doing, these states are constantly something that visits us often and often. Recently, I was on a trip to Malaysia and Singapore. It's supposed to be kind of like a holiday trip, but then different things came out. There was presentations, there was talks, there was a wedding I had to attend, and there was a speech I had to give. So it became part of like a holiday, but a lot of work type of a holiday. And at the last part of the trip, the body decided that not going anymore. Sore throat for the rest in Singapore hotel. Not going out. Even if we take good care of ourselves, there will be times when we are faced with challenging situations or life circumstances, whether we are sick or not, whether we're meeting with challenges, stress, this and that. And what is it that Buddhism can offer? If not, there's no point for us practicing or involving ourselves into this practice at all. The Buddha says, if this practice or whatever that I teach is not useful for you right now and can be seen and can be felt and realized and experienced right now that brings you benefit, then re-examine whether this is my teaching or not. And it is useful for us to also examine whether this is something that we want to involve in. We want to spend time in studying or practicing it. But at the heart of it, what is Buddhism about? Now, different people will have a different view of what Buddhism is. Let's be honest here. But what is at the core and the heart of it? Where all different traditions all agree that this is the heart and core of Buddhism. What it is there to do. Buddhism, in fact, is a path of training of our mind. To put it simply, if we put all the trappings of it aside, put all the external layers aside, at the heart of Buddhism, it is all about cultivation of states of mind, or cultivation of our mind, training of our mind. Because all Buddhist practices come back towards training the mind. Meditation, obvious. Chanting is to bring back the mind towards focusing what is there. Prostration, some people practice that. It is in fact a physical thing from the external side, but it's a more mental thing. How is your mind, the purity, the focus of your awareness? So each and every practice of Buddhism comes down towards the training of the mind. Because at the end of the day, the Buddha says, life can shoot the first arrow at you because of circumstances, because of stress or one thing or another. There will be distress that happens. This is like life shooting the first arrow at us. And it says this arrow is inevitable. As long as we are alive, there will be situations where it pushes to a corner and create difficulties for us. But then he went on and said, but then the way that we react to this first arrow is like shooting a second arrow at ourselves. Now this is important. He says life shoots the first arrow at us, inevitable. Right? In life there is pain. Let's be real about it. But the way we relate to life and relate to our own pain ends up shooting a second arrow at ourselves. And he says this second arrow is optional. You don't necessarily have to suffer more, because you yourself inevitably added an additional layer to it. And it says the first arrow can't be fixed. That's reality. But the second arrow is where, when we train our mind so that we are able to relate well to our internal experiences and external circumstances, that is where the life of peacefulness is. The life of real peacefulness and happiness doesn't come from a life that there's everything is all nice and rosy. It's not. In fact, people who are living the life like that very often find that there's a lot of boredom, a lot of agitation, a lot of frustration, and then they turn to other things to numb themselves, avoiding it one way or another, or drugs or whatever it is. So it's not really about what life throws at us, but it is in how we respond and react to these life experiences. That is where the real difference is. And at the heart of Buddhism, the whole practice is about training the mind so that there are qualities of the mind that help you live a life of peacefulness and happiness. To build the stability and the strength of the mind so that whatever comes, you're able to face it. That is the heart of Buddhism. Someone once asked the Buddha, "Can you please summarize your entire teaching into something simple? Because there's just too much information out there. What can you summarize as the core and the heart of your teaching?" And says, "Okay, good. Good that you asked. Because my teaching is not about huge philosophies. It is about practical stuff." Says the entire teaching, and many of you have heard this over and over again. This is important. Says my entire teaching can be encapsulated in this. That which is wholesome for you, hang on, let me take a second. That which is not wholesome, not good, avoid as much as possible. Things that you know are harmful for yourself and harmful for other people, avoid. Things that are helpful for yourself and other people, try to do as much as possible. But it doesn't quite end there. The third part, he says that the purification of the mind, that is the additional part that the Buddha has greatly contributed. The first two parts is like morality and doing good, right? That which is not wholesome, that is not good, we avoid. That is morality, having good morals. That which is good and wholesome, cultivate as much as possible. That's a practice of wholesomeness, of doing good. But then it says purifying all, in a way, in brackets, training of the mind. Because purifying the mind is purifying it from the tendencies that create more and more trouble for us. The purification of the mind, that is a large contribution that the Buddha gave. And this, he says, is the teaching in its entirety of the Buddhas in the past, in the present, and in the future. So to summarize what the heart and the nutshell of Buddhism is, avoid that which is unwholesome, practice that which is wholesome, purify your mind. Those are the teachings of the awakened ones. And all these three aspects, avoiding, doing good, and purification of the mind, all comes from here, the mind, or the heart in some different translation, cultural translation. It all comes from here. So the entirety of the teaching is in refining and developing here. And there's one aspect of the teaching that has no greater emphasis in all different traditions than the practice of mindfulness. Traditionally in Pali it's called sati. And it depends on the different translations, different terms in different traditions of Buddhism. The practice of mindfulness is key. I'm glad that Buddhabhas chose to use this as the theme for the Bodhi Night this year. Because mindfulness is encapsulated in the Eightfold Path, in right mindfulness, basic training. It's encapsulated in the five spiritual strengths, which is the five strengths that one cultivates on the path, the third one being mindfulness. Out of the seven factors of enlightenment, it is number one. The first factor of enlightenment, that is mindfulness. So mindfulness is one key aspect that strings all aspects of Buddhism together. Why? Because this is the first and foremost quality that one needs to have. Because without mindfulness, you cannot avoid that which is unwholesome. You don't even know, there's no clarity. You're not aware of what you're doing. You can't even avoid. To be able to practice that which is wholesome, you have to first know what they are. And secondly, be aware of how you're behaving. That requires awareness. And in the purification of the mind, now that's a big word, but how Buddhists purify the mind, it's not that it goes through a filter and then comes out the other way pure. It's not like that. In fact, the best way of purification of the mind in Buddhism is through the practice of mindfulness. By observing reality as it is from moment to moment, and from there, as mindfulness grows, it gives rise to understanding of reality. As understanding matures, it creates deep insight into the true nature of phenomena. And as deep insight occurs, wisdom arises. With wisdom, it cuts through the pain and the distress that one has, because it cuts at the root level of how we are reacting to our internal experiences. That is why mindfulness is at the core of it. It's at the heart of it. And no rightful mainstream Buddhist traditions can deny the position of mindfulness in the entire teachings of the Buddha. Because without awareness, clarity of state of mind, then there's nothing that can be developed further. Now I know some of you may be a bit hazy as to what mindfulness really means. So let's unpack it a bit more. Mindfulness is a state of mind that we all have. In order to be aware of that you are living, that you can pay attention to this talk right now, you know that you are here, you're writing down, you're listening, all this needs some level of awareness. If you're asleep, you don't know what's happening. Right, and then someone nudges you. Suddenly the door opens, you wake up, mindfulness kicks in again. Oh, okay. Right? So that is the basic level of mindfulness that we all have. But Buddhism takes this quality and state of mind that is already existent, and it trains it and develops it even more. And develops it and refines it, so that it trains it to be clear and more aware of moment-to-moment experience as it arises. Awareness needs to be aware of something, right? When we say we are aware, it's awareness of something. As far as the context of Buddhism is concerned, the awareness is of present moment reality that arises in the body and in the mind. Now repeat this. As far as the context of Buddhism is concerned, the mindfulness is being mindful of the state of our body and the state of our mind from moment to moment. And then the next question comes, why do we want to do that? Because once we are able to see reality as it is from moment to moment, then that begins the process of seeing reality as it is. We go through life very often in kind of an automatic mode. Something happens, we react, and that's it. Before thinking of something, a reaction has occurred. Right? You shift in your chair. There must be a reason why you shift, but it's all automatic. Oh, there's a bit of discomfort, and so you shift. Right? But a lot of these things are subtle, and maybe there's no much reason to be aware of it, but more importantly, there are a lot of automatic patterns that we have, reacting with craving, reacting with aversion, that we do not see. That's why we call it delusion and ignorance. Mindfulness cuts to the heart of it by revealing reality as it is. From one moment to another, what is happening in the mind? What is happening in the body? Because through understanding and insight, that is where change can occur. And this change is not a false change. When you see that holding on to something is causing you a lot of pain and distress, when you see it clearly for what it is causing you, then it becomes natural to put it down. Just like a child, if you reason with a child saying that, don't touch that, it's very hot, it's going to... Alright, they may listen to you. When you're away, then you'll be like... But once the moment the hand touches that hot object, immediately let's go. No more reasoning required. And this is like the heart of where mindfulness works. Once we see how we are reacting to situations, the transformation naturally happens. And all the different types of meditation, different types of practice in the world, or at least in the world of Buddhism, all comes down towards cultivating this quality and state of mind. And this is an important quality and state of mind. In fact, science has now more and more look into what this mindfulness business is about. And to summarize it, they've created an acronym for it.
RAIN.
Very appropriate for the weather right now. Must be a lot of people practicing, that's why it's raining so much. RAIN is an acronym for first, we recognize whatever reality is presenting, recognition. Right? This is one first quality of mindfulness. Second, allow and accept. You sit, start to feel sleepy. A lot of you are like, oh, shouldn't I be sleepy? I should be meditating. Remember, allow. It's okay. Reality is presenting itself. You recognize that sleepiness is this state. You're allowing it to come up. You're aware of it. That is the second quality. Third one. Investigate. What's the nature of sleepiness? Sleepiness doesn't come like no. If it is, check it out and see. Sleepiness has a quality to it. It's like a friend comes up next to you, slowly creeps in. Actually, what sleepiness is a bit like this. Comes up to you, next to you.
Oh, Ian, you work so hard. Yeah, take a rest. And then it rocks you gently. There's a floaty movement. And then next thing, bang, you fall asleep. Okay, stay on.
But without investigation, you won't know how sleepiness creeps in. That's why in real mindfulness meditation, at the core, this is traditional teaching, based on the Satipatthana discourses on the four foundations of mindfulness. You use whatever presents itself as the object of awareness. If sleepiness presents itself, you recognize that sleepiness is there, you allow, okay, show me your full glory, investigate it. Where do I feel it? Does it happen more here first? Is there a sense of warmth? Is there a sense of shaking? Oh, this thing off. Investigating. Right? And the last part. Non-identification. You don't say that, oh, this is me, or this is mine. No, you're just looking at it as passing phenomena. Just like a scientist trying to look at something else. Objectively looking at something. It is that type of quality. You're not identifying, not saying, oh, this is good, this is bad, not engaging with it, not identifying with it. That is the quality of mindfulness. And I think out of the different types of description of mindfulness, this one is pretty close, coming from modern science. And this kind of highlights the different aspects and importance of mindfulness. To be able to recognize a state as it arises. If someone says something, you're angry, you're frustrated, you recognize anger has arisen. Okay? You allow, it's okay. A reaction has taken place. You investigate, where do I feel it? I feel tightness here, there's heat here, there's an urge of wanting to do something. Right? And then, you don't identify with it. You don't kind of say, oh yeah, this is so bad. It's a person, You don't identify in that storyline. You watch that storyline. There's a lot of things playing. But your mindfulness slowly enables you to continue to develop these four aspects of it. And you're able to do it better and better. So next time someone says something that's not nice, of course, naturally you will feel unpleasantness. But before someone says something, the next thing is already that. Right? Oh, sorry. Right? But as your practice develops, when something is triggered, you're very aware. And then you can choose not to act in the habitual way. Not to react in the habitual way, but you can act in whatever way is most suitable in the environment. Okay? This will all come together when we talk about busy people especially. But you can start to see its implication already.
When we are busy, we are constantly operating at a very automatic level. We're engaging from one thing, move to another, move to another. There is no real recognition allowing investigation. Oh. No rain. Drought. When you're having a very busy time. But mindfulness cuts that and says, you need to recognize what is allowed, it's presenting itself. This is very different from suppressing. Right? This is not, and this a lot of people get it mixed up. They think that Buddhism teaches you, when you're really angry, I'm a good Buddhist, push it down, stay down. It's not. Buddhism don't ask you to force and fake compassion. That's ridiculous. But in the name of Buddhism, oh, some people say, I'm a good meditator. No such thing as anger. I missed the point. Because at the heart of Buddhist practice and mindfulness practice is our ability to recognize reality as it is. It's not about suppressing it. Yes, there are times whereby when it's overwhelming, when a state is overwhelming, it's useful for us to distract for a while or avoid for a while, then to come back later when we are more able to. But at the heart of our Buddhist practice, don't get it mixed up. And this is where a lot of people, I say Buddhism gone ugly. Like the things that I've described. You think that in the name of Buddhism, you become all this, all self-righteous and self-glorified. I don't do anger. Okay, I'm always smiling. This is not reality. The Buddha wants you to see how your anger arises, how your frustration arises. And what state is it that is conducive for your peace and happiness? You see for yourself with clarity and with deep awareness through recognizing, allowing, investigating, and not identifying with experience immediately. And it essentially, what will happen as an outcome of this practice is that two things start to happen. First, the quality of our ability to stay with different experiences improves. Right, let me rephrase this. Our ability to stay with different types of experience, regardless of whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, challenging, nice situation, the state of mind that goes in and out, moves in and out of these experiences, there's a stability that starts to come up. But the ability to stay and experience any type of experience, whether it be pleasant, unpleasant, stress, challenging, the ability to face these experiences with great stability, that starts to develop. That's the outcome of this practice. Secondly, which is even more important, our relationship with our internal experiences start to change. In the past, when we think certain things, it must be reality. It must be that case. But with mindfulness practice, we become dynamic and fluid. There's a sense of cognitive flexibility, is what psychology call it. To put it simply, our ability to take perspective from our internal experiences, that starts to improve. In the past, when we want to do something, immediately we do it. There's no freedom of choice. When the conditions are right, we act a certain way. But now, when experiences that arise do not necessarily dictate where we go, we have a sense of choice and freedom from our internal conditioning, internal habitual tendency. This is what mindfulness allows us to do. And these two qualities are important qualities to have, especially for very, very busy people. When we are busy, we become vulnerable. It becomes easy to tip us over. Right, when we're so busy and then some crisis happens, can't handle it. There's no stability of the mind. But mindfulness, this practice allows the sense of stability, yes. Challenging situation is there. This is an okay situation. You see things very clearly and you're able to move in and out of these situations very freely. Secondly, when we are busy, we're constantly in an automatic pilot. Just go along, move along, reacting to different situations. This allows us the sense of freedom to decide and choose the way that we want to react.
the way we want to respond to a situation. We are not slaves of our own habitual patterns, of our own conditionings of the mind. Because there is then, in arising from there, a sense of freedom and decision. Sense of freedom. Sense of choice. And this is important for us to make good, clear decisions. A lot of people tend to think that Buddhist practitioners tend to be very passive. That Buddhists all only sit, close their eyes, smile. Yes, there are a lot of Buddhists who are like that. Good. Nothing wrong with that. As long as they are aware. But what has freedom got to do with choice? Yes, you can say that there's nothing. Absolutely. You can say that freedom has nothing to do with choice, or you can say that freedom is related to choice. But let's put that aside for now. Okay? If I don't come back, you can ask me later. Some Buddhist practitioners, or people who think that Buddhist practitioners are only one-dimensional, that they're all very slow-moving people. When you go to retreat centers, move slowly, mindfully walking. Yeah, I do that training too. There's a time for that. But really, at the mind level, these people are very efficient. Even during the Buddha's time, out of all his disciples, there were more lay people than monastics. Right, lay people meaning people like you and I, householders. We haven't taken the robes. We haven't become monks or nuns. And out of the lay people, there were some of them who hold very high positions even in government. And there was one which I can't remember his name specifically, but he was a prime minister of a state. So a very high position. And based on his practice, he actually attained very high levels of mental training. He's very well known for that. In the end, he sacrificed himself to save the people running away from a bunch of bandits or when the country was invaded. But this person, when he was alive, being a kind of like a prime minister equivalent today, had to deal with so many things day to day life, and he was a very efficient person. That was during the Buddha's time. Someone a bit closer. Some of you may have heard of the Burmese meditation master, lay person, Sayaji Ubakin. Ubakin is a lay person, Burmese, and trained with the Buddhist monks, under a few Buddhist monks, and attained very high mental states of mental refinement in his practice. He was working for the government, and he was secretary of one department, which in these days is a bit like either the minister or the person second to the minister in the ministry. Okay? So when he started, he was a second man of a ministry. And when his practice developed more and more, he started implementing his meditation practice to the entire office. Say all his staff members had to come and practice to reduce corruption, to increase work productivity, and it's just better for OH&S. So he introduced that. It improved. The whole ministry improved. And then the Prime Minister was very pleasantly surprised. He said, "Very good. Can you do the same for the other ministry?" He says, "That's fine. If you transfer me over to another ministry, I'll do exactly the same thing." But then the Prime Minister says, "But if we move you from this to the next ministry, then this one will fall again." So then, the Prime Minister, at one stage, gave him four ministries to take care of in Burma. You can look this person up, Sayaji Ubakin. He was the head or the second person in charge of four different ministries. That's a lot of work. That's a lot of work. But then he was well known for one thing. When he arrived in his office, he does not leave until his in tray is empty. And he was a great meditation practitioner, and he's also a great meditation teacher, making him a great meditation master, in fact, of our present time. He died about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, so relatively recent. When any case comes to him, he passes judgment, does what he needs to do, next one. The state and clarity of his mind is sharp. His productivity is very high. His mind is as refined as anything. And at the end of the day, does he feel tired? No. Because his mind is very stable. He uses the energy as he needs to and then withdraws the energy when he doesn't need to. Whereas for us, we're like, right? Do this thing a bit and then check Facebook a bit, and then our energy is like scattered. But someone who trains their mind has very focused energy, mental energy. Now, I'm not talking about those new agey stuff. I'm talking about pure mental energy, concentration, the sharpness of the mind. And Ubakin had that ability, and it was well known. Taking care of four ministries at the peak of his career, and teaching meditation in his office at the same time. And I assume the whole ministry worked really, really well. So many people practicing. And in fact, because of that legacy, today, in modern day times, there are a lot of big corporates that are actually implementing this right now. I've spoken to a colleague recently, and she's just recently spoken to Google, and teaching them mindfulness meditation. And there are many organizations as well that's implementing this in a more secular context, taken out of kind of the traditional format of Buddhism. But coming back to the practice of the mind, these people, the ones who practice mindfulness, they have a very sharp mind, the energy is well sustained and balanced, and there's not a lot of wastage. And when they pass judgment, it becomes a good judgment because it's out of the clarity of the mind. But usually we make bad decisions is when our mind is clouded, or when we are strongly overwhelmed by emotions. Usually it's these reasons. Of course there are other reasons, but when the mind is clouded or when we are overwhelmed by emotions, usually we don't tend to make the best decision. But when the mind is clear and stable, you will know that yes, this is the right thing to do. Because the mind is able to hold in its awareness all the important factors, it considers that and then decides that this is the right path. And this is the quality of a trained, refined mind. And our sense of well-being in the physical body, that also improves with this practice. In the 1970s, mindfulness became popular. Sorry, let me rephrase that. Mindfulness just became popular now. It started to be researched in the arena of science and medicine in the 1970s, made popular by someone called Jon Kabat-Zinn. Since then, there were a lot of more research that came in. And there was one particular research that I remember, that usually these programs are taught between 8 or 12 weeks. Each week is about 2 hours, the group meets, practice together, and there's homework to do in between sessions. Okay? So they decided to do all these studies, and they found that oh, for this condition it's good, for that condition it's good. And then someone asked, what about people with no specific conditions, people who are working in the field, highly productive people, what benefits are there? They say, fine, let's go. Let's do a randomized control trial in a high-tech company. Right? Take the high-tech company's employers, randomize that into mindfulness, non-mindfulness group. Okay, after 8 to 12 weeks, let's see how they go. After 8 to 12 weeks, they find that the overall sense of well-being, tension is gone down, well-being goes up with the mindfulness group. That's not the surprising data or result, for me anyway. What happened was that during the process, the later part of the course, it was flu time. It was kind of a bit of a flu outbreak. So a lot of people were having flu, and thought, oh, maybe this program cannot continue on. But never mind, let's just run it anyway. People come, they come. And then when they subsequently analyzed the data, what they found was that the group in the mindfulness group reported significantly less people, excuse me, with flu compared to the non-mindfulness group. That was one of the earlier suggestions, that it actually impacts on our immune system as well. Subsequently, different studies using swab. Using swab is swapping for stress hormones. Studies like that have shown that the overall stress levels have reduced. The overall sense of well-being, physiological response has improved. And then they continued more studies. They went to look at running mindfulness courses for health professionals. Now, if you think that you are stressed, right, chat with someone in the health profession, like doctors, or especially come just recently graduated doctors. We have some in here, right? Either don't answer phone or just too tired, right? Just burnout, right? That's very common. In fact, it's the same for psychology. People in the first 5 years of graduating from a psychological postgraduate course burn out the quickest. Or they burn out during their training as well. Same, health professionals. They ran courses for health professionals. Again, 8 to 12 weeks. And what they found is that for the health professionals who undergo mindfulness training, they report greater sense of well-being, again, lower stress, lower tension, increased work productivity, greater efficiency. Busy people? Absolutely. More efficient people? Yeah. Less downtime? Absolutely. I think this should be funded by the government. And they also did studies on therapists in training. People like me, when I went through my training, can tell you it was a very stressful time. Because you're going through a period whereby you're working with real people, real problems, and you're still learning how to use the tools. So it's like a taxi driver that has just recently learned how to drive. It's a bit like that. Right? You're working, people come in, to the airport, quick! You're like, okay, first gear, clutch. So it's a bit like that psychologically. Therapists in training undergo a lot of stress because they're working with real people's issues, but they're still not very apt at using the psychological strategies or working with clients. Again, high level burnout. Did 8 to 12 week courses, and they found that a significant difference between those who do it and those who don't. To the point that some organizations are now considering for therapists that to make this a core component of therapist training, which is excellent. Busy people? Very much so. Now I hope you're starting to get the drift now of what essentially mindfulness can do. The training of the mind, the development of clarity and awareness from present moment experience from moment to another, being able to deeply understand and look into our experiences, that ability protects us. It sharpens our awareness, sharpens our mind, protects us, improves our ability to work with different types of situations. In fact, I remember a specific research now. You heard of Matthew Ricard? How many of you have heard of Matthew Ricard? Okay, you. Matthew Ricard is French? Let's say it's French. I think trained as a physicist. Anyway, one of the sciences. Right? Bear with me for a bit vague on the detail. Sorry?
Geneticist.
Okay. Assist. Okay? Geneticist. Right? He's a very done very well in his professional life as a scientist. Then he subsequently went and became a monk in the Tibetan tradition and practiced for many years. I think about 10 or more than that. In seclusion, in practicing meditation. Until a certain point whereby his teacher says, it's time for you to go back and work with the real world. So then he came out subsequently and then met with a group of researchers. And some of you may have seen this in, I think, New Scientist magazine. There was one edition that says, Buddhists are the happiest people on earth. Something like that. Some catchy line like that. Time magazine came out as well. What they did was Matthew Ricard's brain
they scanned it, right, and looked at the activation points when he was doing his meditation practice. But initially, they didn't release who it was. They just say that they looked at a Tibetan monk who's done years of extensive practice, look at the fMRI scans of the activation of different parts of his brain. And what they found is that the parts associated with well-being, with a sense of happiness, that was greatly activated in his brain. And that's why it was known as the happiest brain in the world. Very nice. But that's like long-term practice. So that's not the interesting part here, but that's a bit of background of Matthew Rita. So he's currently still a monk, he's traveling all over the world, he's author of many books, and he was recently in Australia, I think last month he was in Australia. What they did, and this was told by, I can't remember his name now, Goldman or Goldstein? Goldman. I think it's Goldman. During one of the conferences he reported that they, for the sake of looking at brain scans, they got Matthew Ricard, right, poke on his brain, and then they invited at the university, this is a research university, they say, who is the most notorious professor around in the entire university? Worst reputation, like the meanest, cruelest person. If you go near them, you turn into ice. That part of the professor. So I find us the hardest person to work with. So they got the list. Right? Everyone agreed. Oh, yeah. Then they contacted this professor. Now, in the interest of science, will you care to be invited for a research? And this research is quite creative. We are wanting you to engage in the debate with Matthew Ricard. And the topic is, all academics should spend 10 years in seclusion in meditation. And you have to agree. Then the first person says, I'll think about it, but no. True to his reputation, wasn't easy to work with. So they said, let's find the second person. Second most difficult professor in the university. They found, okay, and he agreed. Okay, for the interest of science, I will engage in debate with this, whoever this monk is, right? So this is the professor, again, hooked on. What they found was that before the debate began, that was the interesting data, that's the baseline data they were looking at. Matthew Ricard's brainwave, stable, optimized. Is that when you, after you, I don't know, defrag or you optimize your computer, it runs very well. This was like his brainwave, Matthew Ricard, before the debate. The professor, his brainwave. Right? Agitation, a lot of restlessness, agitation. And it showed in the EEG, I think they were using EEG at this stage. You can see the brainwaves. Right, what type of alpha, beta, gamma waves? Baseline, you can see the difference. 10 years of practice and reputation. The story doesn't end there. 10, 15 minutes into the debate, Matthew Ricard was just giving his point, right? And his brain waves were always like this. Good. Professor's one went from like this both resonated. You know what happened? In within 10 minutes of the interaction, Matthew Ricard's wave influenced him to be like this. You relax, get more at ease, great fun, and laugh. Right? I wasn't there, but Goldman said that it was a pleasure to watch. We all had so much fun. Why? Because this mind, which is trained to be stable, has remained stable. And what it has done is that it has influenced this other mind, being in contact with them. have changed their brain pattern, their mind, their brain activation pattern. That is powerful stuff. And you know that. When you come across someone who is very agitated and stressed, you get near them, you also feel agitated and stressed. Right? You go to someone who is very calm, talking to you, everything seems okay. There is, we know that there's a sense of that. Right? That's why we don't like being around people who are very negative vibe. And we as therapists see people like that very often. And for us, we have to be aware of our own activation and to be allow a sense of containment and stability for our clients. You know, we know that anecdotally, but this is through the brain scan that actually shown that. So imagine if you're a very busy person, if your life is one thing after another, you have to interact with different people, and your brainwave is like this. As you walk past, people can almost feel it. Right? You go home to your partner, family, your dog. The dog was the one. Because we do not exist in a vacuum, right? I say. But someone who is very busy most likely interacts with more people than others. That's like a fair correlation, right? If you're very busy with different things, you're often relating with more different people. And if you're like a destructive pattern going around, it causes more damage, more likelihood of bad relationships. But if you're a focused person, stable, very efficient, very sharp, then the influence that you have on other people, that's a positive, constructive thing. It happened to me personally. There was an event 2 years ago that I organized as part of a large organization. I was one of the key person that in charge of the event hall. So that's a huge job to have. My duty was to make sure that the speakers, everything was placed properly. I decide where the tables will go, where the chairs will go, how the running of the day will go. A bit similar to body night, just at a different scale, right? At the professional scale. What happened is that I started to get very dizzy. And I started to get a bit frazzled. Because at the end of the day, we were trying to prepare, tomorrow the conference was starting, started to get tired, get a bit cranky. Then there was one point we had to decide where to put the chairs for the speaker on the stage. And then the head of the organization came and says, right? So we were not seeing eye to eye. He said, you have to do it because of... I said, but then this is my responsibility. So there was tension going on. And then it went to a point that I wasn't happy, he wasn't happy. But he was more senior. Lose my seniority. But anyway, then I went away for a bit, and then it suddenly occurred to me, it kicked in. Hang on, what's happening now? There's a lot of tension here, a lot of frustration here, a lot of anger here. Immediately when I recognized that, when you practice this a lot, immediately it diffuses. Right? When you're used to not identifying with it, it's identifying with it that makes it grow more. It's like, yeah, you shouldn't have said that. That is what creates more and more. But when you disengage with it, it falls. So the moment that I was aware of it, it just kicked in. I didn't say, I'm a good Buddhist, I shouldn't. I was just aware, okay, that dropped. Was I feeling unpleasant, frustration? Yes, it was still there in the background. Not half as strong. Then I went back into the hall and told the person, whatever his name is, I'm confidential, I won't tell you. So and so. Really sorry. Really, it doesn't really matter whether we put it there or put it there. It's just as gone with nothing. I do want to apologize. So I said that. This person initially was also. Shit, hand on. Conference went on well. Right? It is. Relationally, you will see when you have the awareness that kicks in like that becomes your protection.
that becomes an immediate reminder for what is important here. Because my mind was so involved in that, I am the hall manager. How dare you, I know you're senior than me, but how dare you come in and tell me where to put my table, because I know that that's the best way to put the table. There's no argument there. I'm so held on to my view. But really, when I'm able to disengage from that, it's like, really? 2 feet there, 2 feet here? So what? Right? He says that more people can, okay. And if we really insist on that, and it's not a huge damage, he didn't say that, you know, put the speaker like behind the hall or something, it's still relatively acceptable, then it's okay. But it's when I'm very holding on strongly, and I don't see that when I'm very busy here, when the mind is cloudy, when it's vague here, when there's no clarity, there's no stability, that is when you're very kind of just floating around. That's when you are becoming the slave and conditionings of your mind. Because there's no real sense for you to say, okay, right, this is fine, but this is what I choose to go with. For me, that's a sense of openness. Or whether or not you want to call it freedom. But at least I had a sense of choice. Okay, like this is not in line with what I want things to be. But without initially mindfulness kicking in, there's no way of that turning around. If that didn't happen, I'll still probably today have very bad conflict relationships with this person. But no, because of that one incident that we became real with each other and let go of our individual view. When I allowed myself to let go, he softened too. And he softened, he just allowed things to flow. You have a relationship? If you're in a family, if you're in a community, if you're staying with someone, these things come up time and time again. It's when we are able to create practice around and cultivation of our mind, that's when it really makes a difference. So to put it all in context, Buddhism essentially is a path that teaches us the training of our mind. And out of all different trainings, the most important training is that of awareness. That of being aware of reality as it arises. Not just a philosophical conceptual understanding of how the world is, a worldview. In that sense, Buddhism is not a philosophy. It is a practical day-to-day life implementation of the actual practice. And from the results of the practice, you see for yourself how that changes your life. And in its practice, in its core of it, it's a practice of the heart and the mind. It's a cultivation, development, qualities that are conducive for a life of peacefulness and happiness. A life of stability. A life that's able to come what may and still remain stable. A life that's deeply aware and in touch with what reality presents itself from moment to moment, and not just living in the sense of what we make of the world, but being really true to what reality is. It doesn't avoid experience. It doesn't try to cover an experience. It is deeply in touch with whatever arises. That's why recognition is important. Allowing and acceptance. Is that a question?
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I mean, I guess the question I kind of have, I don't expect it to be really answered, what about when it sort of seems impossible to recognize? Especially these days when we're interacting with so many people, the internet, we're expected to process things. People are affecting each other a long distance.
Absolutely.
But we're not, it's impossible, there's not actually enough time to recognize what is going on.
Yep. I agree with you fully. That because of the way we live our life, we have set ourselves up to continuously go on this race like this. This practice says that at times you have to practice some of these qualities of the mind. And I'll go into it in the last part of it, specifically how. Right? So I'll come back to that. But I agree with you that if left unchecked, we are just going on like this constantly. That's why stress and anxiety is getting so high. That's why there's so much business for clinical psychologists these days. Depression, anxiety. Ayo. Why? Because we are like this. But Buddhism says that there are times whereby we need to train and set aside time. We know that it's important to brush our teeth each day, because if not, our teeth will fall and rot. We brush our teeth. Waste time? A few minutes. We know that it's important to keep our body healthy. We do some exercise, we take care of our nutrition. That's important. We do that, we eat, yes. However busy, we still eat. Sometimes people skip meals for a bit, but after a while it comes back, they still eat. But how about the mind? What are the nutrients that we need to put into our mind? It is these type of training that allows us to become more resilient towards life as it is right now. But really, probably the threat has been different, but essentially life has, its quality has been the same. Maybe today is the, I don't know, stock market or whatever. 2000 years ago it was the tiger or the blockade. Right? The stresses that has been all the time 2000 over years ago and now, just that it's taken different sense, but it's becoming more intense in its speed and intensity as well. So it's important for us to do physical exercises to build our physical health. It's also important for us to do mental exercises to improve our mental health. And you're right, sometimes it becomes overwhelming. It's a bit like if we don't exercise, we don't take care of our health. And sometimes we come to a situation and someone says, can you help me move the table? Can you?
Sure.
You don't have the physical strength, but this is when it's overwhelming physically. Same thing psychologically. But small things is alright, but something that's major that's hit, and we see that a lot, unfortunately, you know, in my work, when there's some crisis happens, a loss that happens, an impact that happens, those are the big ones. But if we do not train ourselves from moment to moment to be, to live a healthy lifestyle, to work on our health physically, if we go to the gym, do exercises, you know, as we develop, one day, it becomes easy to lift it up. The same thing for the mind. There are no shortcuts here. In terms of the how and the method, we need to find time. Just as we find time to eat, we find time to brush our teeth. How many of you don't brush your teeth? Just in case. Okay. The correct analogy. We eat. We brush our teeth. We take care of our physical health. So too, we need to take care of our mental health. Because the statistics is already projected, and I think we are doing better than what was projected, that mental health will become the greatest consumption of any health fund in the world in not too far down the track. And that's scary. Even for us as health professionals, we feel that there are not enough of us to service the needs ahead. So it is important for us to build the resilience when times are okay. You do not only go to the gym when you're falling sick. In fact, when you fall sick, you need time to recover. But it's when times are okay, that's when you do your training. You do your exercises. You eat well. You sleep well, whatever it is. So that when you have your assignment period, whatever period that is busy, you can weather that out a bit more. Same thing psychologically. When you have the ability and a chance to do your practice and to train the mind, then do the practice. Attend courses if you need to. Right? Attend Unibuddha. Lunchtime meditation. Right? Learn to work, to train and develop the qualities of the mind. Because at the end of the day, that is the most important asset that we have. And that is the most powerful productivity tool that we have. But it can also be the greatest destruction in terms relationally and internally. This is powerful stuff. But no one really talks a lot of taking care of it. And this is quite scary. And we need to awaken to how important this is. To have, firstly, in the how, have a regular practice. Even if you're doing 3 minutes a day of just being aware of your breathing, bringing a sense of awareness, honing your awareness. And if you do not know how to practice, get someone, a guide or teacher or whatever, to help. Attend workshops or whatever it is that you need to do. Have a regular practice, first one. Secondly, sprinkle awareness and breaks throughout your day. And when I talk about breaks, it's not break from something and then go on Facebook for a while. It's not that kind of break. Right? That is not a break. That is multitasking again. Taking a break, for example, before I start my day, I sit for a period of time in practice, my mindfulness meditation. And when I'm having a very busy day, I make sure I pause and just bring awareness back towards recognizing what's happening, allowing, investigating, and then non-identification. It's hard for me because it takes time to develop a practice, a mindfulness practice. I can't tell you or give you a CD, say that, okay, this is it, and go home and do it. It's a life practice. You build from one layer to another, develop from one quality to another. Okay? But get somewhere, read or whatever it is, it's appropriate for you, learn something to help your mind. Have a regular practice. Sprinkle your practice throughout the day. When you have time that you're waiting, instead of when you're waiting for something to load, moment of awareness, aware of how my body is. If there's tension, just allow the sense of awareness towards the tension. And that will start to spread throughout the different parts of your life. So that's the second one. Third one. Build it into certain types of habitual activities that you do. For example, you brush your teeth, you wash the dishes, you move up and down the stairs, you reach for a door. Anything that you do constantly in the day, drink tea, for example. Do it with awareness. Even in those few moments of awareness, you're just bringing your mind towards being present towards that one thing. It starts to shift the brain activation. It starts to allow it to come into a bit more of a balance. And each day, we balance a bit, balance a bit, balance a bit. This all adds up. For me, whenever I go from my office towards the waiting room to get my client, next patient, or next client, that walk, I'm very aware of my walking. Just being present, being awareness towards the present, which is the movement. And that itself allows me to be more grounded, the mind to be more settled and sharper and more aware. And it doesn't just bring benefit to myself, it brings benefit to whoever I'm seeing as well. When I bring the person into the room, I can connect with them much more quickly. But if there's a day I'm just hazy, tired, stressed out, it's like, yep, and then I sit down, oops, sorry, wrong file. Things like that happen, callousness kicks in. But when there's a sense of awareness, and you just know, and you can feel your way through. And it's the same thing, when you are supporting other people in your life, when you feel more grounded in yourself, you know better what to do with someone else's difficulties. You know this. You have friends, you have people around you. When you're feeling like this, you're not in any position to be supporting anyone else. But when you have a sense of stability, even if you can't do much, the presence is there. You can allow yourself to hold them, psychologically, mentally, emotionally. So, first one, having a regular practice, that's important. Secondly, sprinkle moments of awareness and pauses. Bring your awareness back towards the breathing. Just for a few moments in the day, that's important. Sprinkle that throughout the day. Consistency is more important than large chunk here, large chunk there, there's no consistency in between. Right? You rather do each day 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute, than one chunk, 1 hour every month. Right? You do your math, see which one works out better. But I can tell you the results wise, so each minute a day, that is more powerful. Because our brain works in firing. We fire more consistently in certain patterns, that part of the brain starts to change. And the structure starts to change. This is neuroplasticity. Okay. So, regular practice, sprinkle your awareness throughout your day. Take routine exercises in the day to day and do it with awareness, whether it be drinking that cup of tea. Right? Some people, whenever they reach a doorknob, just aware of turning the doorknob. For me, whenever I see stairs, that's the time for me to be aware of my movements up the stairs. It's like a good practice for me. And when we go up the stairs, we're just thinking, oh, no, 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 no. Right? Why not we just bring our awareness to the moment? Right? This few breaks in between, these are the key ones. And if you can't do any of that, at least be aware when you're eating. We all eat, yeah? Bring a sense of awareness when you're eating. For your sake, for the food's sake, right? And for your psychological, emotional, mental state. Why? Because when we eat, we often are not eating. We're eating this meal. If you're from Asia, you may be thinking of the next meal. Or you're thinking of a problem, an issue, or planning. You're often somewhere else. If we can bring a sense of awareness towards our food, that's the best way to eat, because we show gratitude towards the food that we prepare. Secondly, we allow ourselves to train our mind as we eat. Thirdly, and one of my teachers said this, and I must fully agree, the best ingredient in any food, any cuisine in the world, starts with M, not McDonald's. Mindfulness. If you are bringing a sense of awareness towards your food, with appreciation, being aware of the sense of chewing, you can eat normal speed even, you don't need to slow down, but being aware of that. But that is already training the mind to be aware, to be present, to be aware, to be present, to be aware, to be present. And this becomes a habit, it becomes natural for you. So even if you can't do the practice, regular, all these things, when you eat with awareness, each day at least one meal. And then some of you say, but I can't. Okay, first bite of each meal. I can guarantee you that very often the first bite, we are not even aware. Especially if you are with other people, even if you're by yourself. They're like, oh, so hungry. That's what the bite is. Oh, put it in. Chili. But you're not aware, but you're fully present, this is the first spoon. After that you can eat minus two, but that will grow. But you start small, but you start consistently. And this will become a habit. Because our habit right now is to rush, like you said. We're conditioned to be moving like this all the time. If we do not find space and time to allow ourselves to take care of the mind and the brain, then we are in for a huge risk ahead. So, let me summarize and prepare to close for the evening. And I'll take questions after as well. The pace of life these days is such that a lot of things are constantly in the flow, constantly in the flux, and at such great speed, with such rapidity. And because of that, we have become very productive as a community, human race as a whole. That's a good part of it. But there's a shadow of it as well. And we see, and I see in my field, is that tension is going up, stress is going up, health is affected, a sense of relationship with other people, that's becoming more conflictual. We cannot deny that being busy has its pros and has its cons as well. With its pros, let's leave it as it is. But when we take it to the nth degree and it becomes extreme, it starts becoming destructive and not useful for us anymore. And that's why in Buddhism, what it offers is that the Buddha says, of all my teachings, it's all about liberation, freedom, sense of lightness, clarity, peacefulness. And it comes from work, effort in training the mind. Certain qualities of the mind, certain states of the mind that are important for growth, important for a state of peacefulness and happiness. And out of all the different practices at the heart of it sits this quality of awareness, mindfulness. That being aware with clarity and awareness from moment to moment of the reality that arises, to recognizing it, allowing and accepting it, investigating into reality and not identifying immediately. Through this process, what starts to change is that the stability of the mind starts to develop, and the relationship we have with our internal experiences, that starts to shift, that we do not become slaves or conditioned. We do not only react or act out of our old habitual tendencies, but we have a sense of choice, a sense of lightness, a sense of distance, a sense of being able to stay with different experiences more and more. And this is the core and the heart of Buddhist practice when we talk about the actual practical applications of it. Science has recently kind of caught up in the last 10-15 years and started to channel a lot of data about the usefulness of it. But that's all science. That's all the people, good for them, good for Matthew Ricard, good for the Buddha. But what do we do for ourselves here? Are we taking care of what is important for us? Or are we just looking at this as just data, data, data? We can read a million fitness books, but if we do not take care of our own health, no use. Same thing, you can look at a million points of data, evidence, and do not make any changes in our lives to develop the things that are useful for us to increase our resilience. There's no use. It's important for us that to continue to cultivate the types of qualities of the mind that protect us, that creates resilience, that creates the strength that is needed to face the different challenges that we have. And in doing that, find a regular practice. Right? Find a practice that's suitable for you. There are different types of practices out there. Find one that's suitable for you. Try to sprinkle your awareness and breaks, allowing yourself to come back to the present in different points of your life. When in motion, when in movement, when in your day-to-day life, try to bring in a sense of awareness into your routine activities. The things that we do the most mindlessly, those are the best places to start. Brushing your teeth, going up and down the stairs. If you can't do any of that, try to eat with a sense of awareness, because that's the best gift that we can give to ourselves and whoever prepared the food for us. And it's when we do these small things here and there, that we start to see that there's actually a shift in our own lives. Because I say at the beginning of the talk, if we do not have any benefit in practicing the Buddha's path, then why bother practicing to begin with? We have to find a reason, find a link, at least it makes a conceptual sense for us. Then we embark on a journey, and in the journey we reflect and see whether this is something that continues to help us develop our ability to face the different ups and downs in life. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll open it up to everyone. Thank you.
You know how just now you say that people will affect people's like, because I tend to work around people that are very rowdy. Is there a way that can influence them, or do I have to start from myself? Is that the only way, or can I there's a standing shortcut?
No. Let me switch this off. I don't tend to like to record questions. I'll leave your recording up. There are no real easy ways of influencing others, but really it all starts from ourselves. Because even if we can think of different ways of influencing others, right, what is the mind and the motivation behind that? Right, is it driven by our own emotions? Is it driven by our own strong views towards ourselves? And if it is, even you may be very successful in doing that, in influencing others with, you know, reading, I don't know, all different types of works or psychological literature. Depends on what is motivating and driving it from behind. But we need to constantly work on our mind so that the motivation and the intention comes from a good place, comes from a place of stability. When we can do that, then what naturally comes out of that becomes much more conducive. Will we still make mistakes? Absolutely. Will we still go down the wrong path? Yes. But when it comes from a much better place, even if things don't go well, you can come back and say, really, that was from a pure place, a good place. Then there's no sense of a heavy regret in there. So really, we have to take care of the root of the issue, not just the method. But method you can learn, you can train, to be honest. Right? But then where does it come from? Where is it stemming from? If it's stemming from a place that's like this, unstable, most likely what's going to come out in the long run is not going to be helpful. If it's coming from a place that's good and stable and strong, even if it's short term it doesn't work, long term it will balance out.
Okay.
That's what I think. Okay? So no shortcut, unfortunately. Sorry about that. Yep.
Could you describe, I'm not very familiar with Buddhism or learning tracking now, and
yep.
I'm very, very interested. I wanted to ask you, this method of mindfulness, the RAIN acronym behind you, in terms of dealing with, it sounds like it's mainly useful for negative emotions or thoughts or this sort of thing, when you say you get into these things.
Yep.
What happens when you have, it sounds to me like then you know, you describe the freedom and the choice that comes with the method. What happens when you have positive emotions? I'm just worried that if you apply that to positive things, then you don't identify with them, and so you miss out on them. You become like an empty vessel, just considering everything from far away, and then you see?
Yeah. The non-identification, sometimes people misunderstand it as a disengagement with something, right? There is a slight quality in that, but it's actually fully engaged in it and seeing it for what it really is. It's really, that is how we really not identify with it. We can see it for just as a phenomenon. So what happens is that from my personal experience and also working with others is that what usually happens is that when negative emotions start to arise, you're able to watch it as a phenomenon and drops off. Positive emotion comes up, the same thing, arises and then drops off. But usually what happens is that when there's a positive emotion that comes up, then there's something else, there's a reaction that's unhelpful that comes along with it. Sometimes of wanting things to continue on, or worried that this may end, or there's some form of anxiety sometimes that's tagged along in that. Right, you're having a great time out there, and then you suddenly think, oh, but then my assignment, this and that. But sometimes there's something that latches onto it. Even a sense of openness, then sometimes I won't say sometimes, very often it triggers a state of mind that is of clinging, of wanting it to be a certain way or not wanting it to be a certain way. What essentially with this practice is that the positive state arises, but the clinging part is reduced. So you can then see reality for what it is. So in fact, positive experience become more real, because there's no veil of this is a beautiful cup, it has arisen, it's beauty in it. In the past, beauty, oh, what if I break this? You're missing the beauty already. Right? And therefore, sometimes people are worried about creativity. A lot of people who start off with meditation worry that we won't be creative anymore. But in fact, we find that it's the other way around. Because you become more real, you become being able to assess things as they are, and to access the reality of something, which allows a sense of more spontaneity to arise.
Without your mind telling you that it's this way or this way.
Yeah, with a less, what we call a bottom-up versus top-down. Bottom-up is the sensory experiences that come in. Top-down is your own judgments and your own reactions to it. What essentially happens is the top-down reduces its potency. Usually there's a strong top-down. We only see what we choose to see. Psychology, heaps of data is suggesting that. The top down suggests what inputs come in. If we choose not to see, we won't see it. But then when we reduce this, and there's more real into the bottom up, the sensory experience, we become more in touch with reality, actually. So beauty becomes beauty. Sadness is still sadness. Up is still up, down is still down. Yeah. It's not, it becomes indifferent. And some people, it backfires when they don't practice correctly. They think that, oh, I should be indifferent. Joy? No such thing, I'm a Buddhist. What? Happy birthday. Happy death coming day. You don't become indifferent, or you don't fake your wisdom anymore. You become, there's joyful, there's joy. There's pain, there's pain. You become more real with things. Other questions? Are you finishing?